We're going to talk about some historical monetary crimes today, beginning with the election of 1868. Before the election of 1868, the front runners of the two influential parties were Ulysses S. Grant for the Republicans and George H. Pendleton for the Democrats. In 1868, the Democratic Party was considered the conservative party. The Republicans were the liberals. We had the Civil War debt to pay off, and the Democrats were in favor of using greenbacks to remove the obligation. The Republicans, on the other hand, wanted the holders of government bonds to be paid in gold or silver. Greenbacks were so popular, though, and the country liked them so well, that it was considered that the Democrats would win not only the presidency, but also both houses of Congress. The New York World newspaper was a very powerful voice at that time, and it was a Democratic newspaper. Manton Marble was the brains of the newspaper, although not the principal stockholder, who just happened to be August Belmont Sr. In 1837, August Schoenberg came to the United States as a registered agent for the Rothschild banking firm of Europe. As you may recall, the Rothschilds had banks in most of the major countries of Europe, England, France, Austria, Germany, and Italy. As soon as he came to these shores, August Schoenberg changed his name to August Belmont. Until the fall of 1867, the New York World newspaper had specifically pledged its support to the Democratic contender George Pendleton. Gentleman George, as he was referred to, because of his very polite demeanor, and he was in favor of paying the national debt with greenbacks. Until the fall of 1867, the New York World newspaper was committed to George Pendleton to be the nominee for the Democratic Party in the race for the presidency of the United States. Then, all of a sudden, the New York World changed course with Pendleton, the bond question, legal tenders, and everything else connected with the subject. Manton Marble changed course, he said, because he had met a man on the mountain in New Hampshire. But those who know believe the man on the mountain was actually Baron James Rothschild of France and operated through an agent in Wall Street, New York, called Belmont. On March 13, 1868, Baron James Rothschild of France had written a letter to August Belmont. Evidently, the letter had been prepared for Belmont to show to leading members of the Democratic Party. The letter was to influence their opinion on the bond question. It concluded with warnings of ruin to those who might oppose the payment of bonds in coin or who might advocate their liquidation in greenbacks. August Belmont entertained a group of Democrats in Washington, D.C., and suggested that they have the Democratic Convention in New York. The Democratic Party had considered holding the 1867 convention in a southern or western state, but on July 4, 1868, the Democratic Party National Convention was held at Tammany Hall in New York with Mr. Belmont as chairman. On July 7, 1868, the Democratic Party at the National Convention passed a resolution which basically said, "If the obligations of the government do not expressly state on their face, or the law under which they are issued does not provide that they shall be paid in coin, they ought to be paid in the lawful money of the United States," which meant greenbacks. The Democratic Party seemed to be going its own way, not the way Belmont had wanted it to go. During that same convention, George Pendleton was nominated on the first ballot with a vote of 105. On the 22nd ballot, General McCook of Ohio suddenly withdrew Pendleton's name and nominated Horatio Seymour of New York, who was an advocate of coin payments, and then they selected him as the candidate of the convention on a single ballot. As governor of New York, Seymour had paid the New York State bonds off with gold. The Democratic Party had nominated a hard money man, but the conservatives still stood by the greenback. even if the conservatives were to win the election, and even if Seymour would approve a bill providing coin payment of the bonds, few conservatives would vote for it as long as their constituents were opposed to coin payments. But on October 18, 1868, the New York World, the mouthpiece of the Democratic Party, published a brief editorial in which its premise was that success could not possibly await the Conservative Party with Horatio Seymour at its head, and some other name should be substituted in his place for President of the United States. This was 3 months after the convention had been dissolved. Not a word had been uttered against Horatio Seymour. Prospects for the party had not seemed so brilliant for many years. No one had the authority to change the presidential candidate or withdraw his name from the ticket. The party could not reorganize in less than 1 or 2 months, and it was now within 2 weeks of Election Day. It was as though the general had gone over to the enemy on the eve of assured victory. The article was telegraphed all over the country by the next morning. No one supposed that Manton Marble would publish such an article without authority from the chief representatives of the party in New York. But the officers of the party, especially in Washington, D.C., wanted verifications that the article had been authorized by the party. The next day, one of the Washington conclave was requested by the committee, and also by President Johnson, to call upon members of the auxiliary committee at New York and clear up all doubts as to the position of the affairs. The Washingtonian tried to call on Mr. Belmont and other members of the auxiliary committee, but all were either out of town or at least not available. He finally went to Mr. Marble's office and had to persistently question him as to the authorization of the article. After much questioning, the frustrated Manton Marble stated that the New York World newspaper was an independent newspaper and he, Mr. Marble, owned the paper and he could print anything he wanted to print. And he had printed the editorial in order to sell more newspapers. The next day, which was Sunday, the Washingtonian was back in D.C. and he went to Mr. Tilden's residence. There he found 5 other members of the Democratic National Committee. He explained to them in great detail about the difficulties he had getting verification as to whether or not the article was authorized by the National Committee, and that if the committee were not responsible for the article, they should say so, and say so at once. With a few objections, it was decided that the Washingtonian was to draw up a paper stating that the World newspaper article was without authority or knowledge of the National Committee, and that victory was still assured if the party held together. While he was writing the paper, Colonel North whispered to him, "I'll venture to say that you will never carry that paper out of this room." With confidence, the Washingtonian replied, "Oh, yes, I shall get it, and when I do get it, I shall at once put it on the wires." When the Washingtonian finished the paper, and it was signed by Mr. Tillman and Mr. Shell, the Washingtonian said, "Gentlemen, I'll just put this on the wire and return." The Washingtonian's hand was on the doorknob when Mr. Tillman ran hastily around the room and seized him by the arm and declared the dispatch should not go out without Mr. Belmont's name being attached to it. The paper was never signed by Mr. Belmont and was never published, and the Conservative Party had nothing to show that the World article was unauthorized by the committee. Seymour got 2.6 million votes. Grant got 2.9 million. During the Johnson administration, a bill had been introduced called the Credit Strengthening Act. This act solemnly pledged its faith to make provisions at the earliest practical period for the redemption of the United States notes in coin. This was a bill that President Johnson had previously vetoed. But on March 18, 1869, the Credit Strengthening Act was passed immediately upon the assembling of the new Congress that had been elected in the fall of 1868 and was the first act passed by that body and the first act signed by the new President Grant. This enhanced the value of the bonds it had issued under the Act of February 25, 1862, and its sequels. When the bonds were first sold, they were redeemable in greenbacks, so they sold at half price. It also enhanced the value of the greenbacks by promising to redeem the same in coin, whereas when the greenbacks were issued, they were sold at half price for war supplies, largely on account of their irredeemability in coin. Because the Credit Strengthening Act made the bonds redeemable in coin, the holders of the bonds collected twice the profits on their investment, and the citizens of the United States paid double the expenses for fighting the war. That was the first crime of the 19th century. Here's the second one. In December 1865, Treasury Secretary McCullough had put through a law to gradually retire the greenbacks. This act provided that $10 million in greenbacks would be destroyed over 6 months and up to $4 million per month thereafter. The vote was 144-6 in favor of retiring the debt in this fashion. Instead of retiring the first $10 million over 6 months, McCullough retired none until 6 months had elapsed. Then he retired the first $10 million all at once. This caused bankruptcies to skyrocket, especially in the northern states. In 1866, there were 632 bankruptcies. In 1867, there were 2,386. Under McCullough, $44 million in greenbacks had been retired. Many were reissued later, and we'll talk about that later. To paraphrase the writer, George Morgan, who said, "Businessmen are beginning to understand that specie resumption and bankruptcy mean the same thing. Financiers moved politically to force the redemption of the 360 million outstanding greenbacks into gold. The New York Chamber of Commerce was anti-greenback, so the New York Board of Trade was formed opposing the New York Chamber of Commerce. The first time the communist menace scare was used to frighten the voters was in 1875. The Cincinnati Daily Gazette warned that a vote for the Democratic ticket is encouragement to a communist revolution. But the true socialist had long opposed greenbacks as a mere social excuse. They tried to defeat the greenback platform proposed at the Pittsburgh National Labor Convention. The Marxist Labor Standard publication attacked the greenback parties and stated, "The disease from which we suffer is not the want of currency, but a planless system of production." Unger wrote of the crash of 1873 that the railroad boom collapsed abruptly in the fall of 1873 and hard times settled over the nation. The blow caught the country by surprise. That year, Jay Cook's banking house buckled on September 18th. 2 days later, on September 20th, the U.S. markets tumbled and the New York Stock Exchange was forced to close for 2 weeks. These failures were blamed on the railroad boom disintegration. But this was also the time when silver was demonetized. We'll talk about silver demonetization later in the program. But in April 1874, the inflation bill was passed. This bill would have increased greenbacks in circulation from 340 million to 400 million. But President Grant vetoed the bill. This veto especially damaged the Republican Party. Grant was accused of having been bribed, and the Republicans lost control of Congress in the 1874 election. With the lame duck congressional session, they enacted the Resumption Act to redeem the greenbacks in gold. The act required someone to have at least $50 in greenbacks, and according to the act, a person could exchange the $50 in greenbacks for $50 in gold. However, a person could exchange $80 in greenbacks and get $100 in banknotes. Wasn't that nice? You could exchange $80 in government paper money and get $100 in bank paper notes. You may recall the National Banking Act of 1863 and 1864 increased the amount of currency banks could print and at the same time reduce the reserve requirements. Yet the sentiment for greenbacks was so popular that in the congressional session of 1876, it looked like the Resumption Act, paying off the debt with gold, would be repealed. But in order to block the repeal, the Banking and Currency Committee and the Ways and Means Committee were packed with gold backers. The bill to repeal was pigeonholed for weeks. This delayed the action to repeal. Finally, in 1877, the House did pass the bill, but it was defeated by the Senate by one vote. It looked as though the United States would need $120 to $130 million in gold reserves to redeem 40% of the greenbacks. But when John Sherman took over as Secretary of the Treasury in 1877, the Treasury had only about $25 million in gold reserves. John Sherman had to borrow gold in order to redeem the greenbacks. Where did he go for the gold? To England, of course. He negotiated with Seligman Brothers, Morton Bliss & Company, Belmont & Company, acting on behalf of the Rothschilds, and Drexel Morgan & Company, representing Julius Morgan of London. That's J.P. Morgan's father. American bankers were upset at this, but they could not complete with the international syndicate. And by the end of 1878, our treasury held $141.9 million in gold. At the same time that the negotiations were going on to borrow the gold, a rumor surfaced that President Hayes was considering redeeming the greenbacks in silver. This upset the members of the syndicate immensely. In 1877, gold was 4% greater than a greenback. After March 1878, it was 12% greater than a greenback. Here is a question for the listeners of this program to ask. Did the United States really need the gold, or did the gold need the support of the United States? And what would the bankers have done with the gold if the United States had not been manipulated through the bankers using their old tricks of B&B, bribery and blackmail, of our lawmakers? The reason the financiers wanted the greenbacks removed was because the greenbacks performed so well, which caused the bankers to lose their vigorish or interest and their speculation. But still to this day, there are $346 million of greenbacks still in circulation. The listener must remember that coin of the time meant either gold or silver coin. Demonetization of silver began when two laws were passed a year apart. This happened in 1873 while the battle was raging of redemption of the greenbacks. Then it continued in 1874 when the coinage laws were revised with 67 parts to the law. This revision of the law eliminated the silver dollar. It didn't do away with the half dollar or the quarters or the dimes, just the silver dollar. One part of the law specified that other silver coins of the United States shall be legal tender at their nominal value for any amount not exceeding $5 at any one payment. The fact that silver was used as money in most of Europe was because France used silver as the basis for its monetary system. France had for quite some time been the dominant country in Europe. The international language at that time was French. If France's money was based on silver, most of the other European countries' money would be based on silver. If France's money was based on gold, most of the other European countries' money would have been based on gold, so on and so forth. The financiers of France, according to Delmar, held thousands of millions of 5 and 6% United States bonds with interest payable in coin. During this period, the French Court of Cassation promulgated a decision in accordance with the Code of Napoleon. The Code of Napoleon, which in effect stated that no man could contract himself out of the law. This meant that contracts for money were equitably discharged in the current money of the day of payment. This principle came down from the Roman Commonwealth. It was upheld by the jurisconsults of the Roman Empire and the various provinces and kingdoms which the empire afterwards split. It was supported by the English Privy Council in the case of the mixed monies, which we talked about on this show on Program 6. It was maintained by the U.S. Supreme Court, which were adjudicated by Chief Justice Chase and a full bench. This alarmed the holders of the United States bonds in France no little, and then some. What would those shrewd Americans do? Perhaps they would strike coins of debased gold, or make coins of pewter or gunmetal. Would they be justified in doing this by law, by history, by precedent, by authority, by the decision so recently rendered by the French Court of Cassation? Yes. The only thing the French could do was to demonetize one precious metal and make the other precious metal the standard of money. The Americans would not stand for the demonetization of gold because they would then have to pay in silver, and silver in the United States had a 16-to-1 ratio against gold. In France, the ratio was only 15-to-1. Each dollar of silver in France is worth 3% more to the Americans. So, they said, let us just demonetize silver. It makes no difference to us. A dollar of gold or a dollar of silver is still a dollar. To the Americans, it is a gain of 3% to surrender their option of the metals. And all bonds purchased at 40 or 50 cents on the dollar will rise to par and over. At that time, there were from 1 billion to 1 billion 500 millions of American government bonds in Europe or held on European accounts. The inception of this project, which soon developed into an active intrigue, therefore stood to win $600 million to $1 billion to the European bondholders. Most people in the United States did not realize that silver had been demonetized until 1876, 2 years after the law was made official in 1874. Then it only became widely known because of a letter to the editor. When the populace discovered it, it was referred to as the crime of 1873. President Grant, even as late as October 3, 1873, in a letter he wrote to Mr. Crowley, he wondered why silver was not brought into the mints and coined into money. This means that even President Grant wasn't aware of it, and he had signed it into law. Alexander Delmar wrote that the silver dollar was dropped purely and simply to enhance the value of the gold dollar, and thus to double the debt of the American people. This was the motive, he said, and there was no other motive. He went on to say that the proof of this is that the very same men, I mean the identical individuals, who betrayed their party in 1868 and who doubled the public indebtedness by promoting the Credit Strengthening Act of March 1869, these same men assisted to again double the debt by promoting the Surreptitious and Codification Act of February 12, 1873 and 1874. Though Congress was assured by its revision committee that no new matter had been introduced to them, the legislation of 1865 to 1874 was no academic experiment, but a sordid crime hatched abroad and brought into this country by the treacherous people who governed the utterances of the New York World newspaper. Of course, Del Mar was referring to August Belmont, Manton Marble, and their financial backer, Baron Nathan Rothschild of London. Alexander Del Mar had been in charge of the United States Bureau of Statistics, and so he organized a United States Monetary Commission to investigate the demonetization of silver. One of his best witnesses was a jurist and banker from France by the name of Henry Cernuschi. He said, among other things, that only the title of the act was read. It was not passed with knowledge or observation of the country. It was not asked for by the people. The press was either unobservant or silent when it was passed. But maybe the most worthy statement was that no adequate or satisfactory reasons for the enactment of the laws of 1873 and 1874 to demonetize silver have ever been given. August Belmont, on the other hand, testified that gold, being the standard of value, cannot rise or fall, and its abundance or scarcity causes a rise or fall in all other prices. He said that the investigating commission should get better statistics from somebody else. He said that silver fell because it had been demonetized abroad. The entire world had demonetized silver, and the French jurist and banker, Henry Cernuschi, said that no country could coin silver alone. He said that it was better to use paper currency than to coin silver if the other nations did not use that metal as money. But on February 16, 1878, the Bland Bill to remonetize silver was passed, 205-72. It required the coinage of from $2 to $4 million per month in new silver dollars. President Hayes vetoed the bill, but he was overridden. The Europeans would have loved for us to remonetize silver so they could dump a lot of their demonetized silver hoards, but we had plenty of producing silver mines. We coined over $378 million in silver coins through the Bland-Allison Act. This was close to the same amount of greenbacks we had outstanding. This did not satisfy the international financiers, however, and in 1890 the Sherman Act was passed, which required the United States to purchase 4.5 million ounces of silver each month. This was about 17 million more ounces per year than the American mines could produce. The Sherman Act allowed the European financiers to exchange their abundant demonetized silver hoards for American gold at the fixed, artificially advantageous price of the Americans' 16-to-1 gold-silver ratio, or about $1.29 per ounce of silver. The United States paid for the silver with treasury notes, which the Europeans quickly redeemed for gold. As the process continued, America would be forced to borrow back the same gold at interest to meet the continuing European redemption notes and bonds of silver for gold. This really put pressure on the Treasury's gold reserves. Alexander Del Mar considered the demonetization of silver to be one of the great monetary crimes in history. Well, the clock on the wall tells me it's time to say so long. Don't forget to join me here again on the next segment of this program about our monetary system.